This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today the head of the Wilderness Society, Bill Meadows, who's been there for almost 14 years now. Bill Meadows, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt. Glad to be here.
It's glad to have you here. Tell me how you got interested in the environment. Were you an environmentalist as a kid, or a bird watcher, or a nature guy?
When I grew up, active in Boy Scouts, hiked, camped, canoed, and so forth, but really didn't think about public policy or engagement in any way outside myself until 1970. And Earth Day came along, and I was fortunate to be here in Madison a few weeks ago to participate in Earth Day celebration, the 40th anniversary, which was wonderful for me because it marked a very positive circle in my life where I started with Earth Day and actually had the – I don't know that it's an honor, but it was a privilege to serve as master of ceremony at Gaylord Nelson's memorial service here in Madison.
Oh, I remember that.
2005.
I was in the audience, and I just remember the best line of the day was a line attributed to his widow. She was there. She wasn't speaking, but it was she was asked about the secret of their 50-year-old marriage, and she reputedly said, "We're both in love with the same man."
I love that story. I may have said that. I have said it. I've told that story many times in talking about Gaylord and Carrie Lee. But, it was – Earth Day was important, but it was what happened next. I actually went to a Sierra Club meeting, and I raised my hand. And whenever you volunteer at a Sierra Club meeting, you are captured. If you have any interest in doing work, whether you're good or not at doing the work, the fact that you're actually willing to commit some of your time to the Sierra Club means a lot. This was in Nashville, Tennessee. I graduated from Vanderbilt University in 1968 and began work in the Alumni Association office right after that. I ended up at Vanderbilt for 20 years as executive director of the Alumni Association. So my career was in alumni development at Vanderbilt University.
But fundraising, I bet.
On weekends and evenings, I was working for the Sierra Club, the Tennessee Environmental Council, Environmental Action Fund, a variety of environmental organizations in Tennessee. We were a small group in those days in the 70s, but I was the group chair for the Sierra Club and on the chapter executive committee. That ultimately landed me a position at the Sierra Club in 1992 when I had the opportunity to direct a $100 million fundraising campaign for the Sierra Club. And then in 1996, I went to the Wilderness Society.
And why did you jump over?
Well, I was offered a position in an organization I respected, and it's been a great opportunity for me. 14 years at a really fabulous organization. So the Sierra Club was a very good training ground. I think it is for a lot of people in the environmental community, but I'm pleased to be where I am.
Now, when you got there, Gaylord Nelson was kind of attached there. I don't know what his title was, of council or something, but he had an office there, I think. And did you have the pleasure of working with him?
When I came in 1996, Gaylord's office was next to mine. Gaylord came to the Wilderness Society in 1981. As he said, when he was involuntarily retired from the U.S. Senate.
And that was a surprise to all of us here in Wisconsin.
Well, I think it was a surprise to him, too. But he wanted to find a way in which he could maintain a commitment to environmental policy. And he had an opportunity to come to work for the Wilderness Society as senior counselor. He did. Added immense power and prestige to the Wilderness Society in the 80s. And, of course, it continued until he died. He was active. He worked every day until roughly a year before he died and added so much to the larger environmental community but to the Wilderness Society specifically in those years.
What was he like as a guy or as someone in the office next door?
Oh, it's funny. He's – he was well known for his stories, and it was almost every day I would spend 20 minutes with him at the beginning of the day. I'd give him a kind of a briefing on what was going on in the policy arena, and he'd always pull out an appropriate story. that would tie it back to a bit of humor almost always. One of the things that was really nice about Gaylord is he and his wife, Carrie Lee, adopted me and my wife when we moved to Washington in 1996. And we became part of their social circle. And they did not go out a lot, but boy, they invited people in. And I would say once a month, Carrie Lee would have a dinner with 15 people, a lot of Wisconsin expatriates in Washington, but people who were tied into the media and to politics. And I was just privileged to be part of that group. And it was over the last 14 years, it's been really a blessing in my life. So,
I'm speaking with Bill Meadows. He's the head of the Wilderness Society, one of the leading environmental organizations in the country. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio, and I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. The Bush administration had a horrible environmental record. What was it like to be in D.C. as head of an environmental organization in those years?
I have had a wonderful life experience at the Wilderness Society. I came to work in 1996 in December. It was right after Bill Clinton had been reelected to his second term. Some may remember that one of the things that President Clinton did in September of 1996 was designate Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah. And that started an idea. He was working in a political environment that was not conducive to legislative success. He had really opposition in the House and the Senate. And so he and Bruce Babbitt, who was Secretary of Interior, and Mike Dombeck, who was Chief of the Forest Service, designed a strategy to protect land through administrative action. And so Bruce Babbitt and Bill Clinton ended up designating 23 national monuments in the last four-year term. And Mike Dombeck and Bill Clinton worked on protection of 60 million acres of roadless policy. I got to be part of that. I was intimately involved in that, building support across the country for those initiatives, pushing both Secretary Babbitt and Chief of the Forest Service Mike Dombeck to be bold. Sometimes they're going to be a little more cautious than those of us in the advocacy community want them to be. So we have a role to play to push, but we also wanted to support. And so that first 4 years for me, being part of a very positive, proactive conservation agenda was quite heady and quite rewarding. The 8 years of the Bush administration were totally defensive. We were defending the places and policies that we had spent literally decades working on. And there was a singular purpose of this administration, of that administration on energy development, on public land. And so you found that there was an eagerness to kind of open every single acre for oil and gas development. We were fortunate in having enough strength, I think, organizationally and enough support politically across the country to push back pretty successfully. So you see that all of the national monuments that were proclaimed by President Clinton still exist. The roadless areas that were designated by Mike Dombeck and ultimately by President Clinton are still roadless, and that policy still prevails. There's a court challenge remaining, but essentially the roadless areas remain roadless. So it was a tough 8 years, but I think during those 8 years we were able to push back effectively.
The one decent thing that Bush did was the protect the area around Hawaii, around the islands there. How did that come about?
You know, it is there were quite a few people pushing for protection of marine areas. There was Jacques Cousteau's son ended up developing a very close relationship with Laura Bush and spent time really talking to her first, but ultimately to the president. And he became enamored. I think all of us who were critical of the president on his environmental policies need to praise him for the work he did on this. It's interesting that he will go down, at least at this point in history. We're hoping that President Obama may exceed him in some way, but he will have the record of protecting the most acres ever for a president. There were two large marine sanctuaries that he set aside. He used the Antiquities Act, the same instrument that President Clinton used to protect national monuments. So these have monument status, but they're marine protected areas and very important work of conservation. I applaud him for doing that.
I'm speaking with Bill Meadows, head of the Wilderness Society. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. How do you assess President Obama's environmental record so far?
Positive. He and the leaders in the Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid both, I think have taken a pretty – what has turned into a very difficult political environment in Washington at least and done about as well as they could in that setting. Specifically, he has appointed good people in the positions of influence. I have had the opportunity to work closely with Secretary Salazar and the Department of Interior and the staff that he's assembled there. They're first rate and really care deeply about conservation. The same is true with the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service, where the Wilderness Society spends a lot of time. First rate people, true conservationists, really trying to achieve some very positive outcomes. I mean, for example, when Secretary Salazar became Secretary of Interior, one of the first things that he did was cancel 77 lease sales that had been pushed through at the last minute by President Bush and the Bureau of Land Management under President Bush. 77 oil and gas leases that had been let in southern Utah near Canyonlands National Park. That's the kind of very strong statement from the beginning that we're going to look at oil and gas energy development in a different way. What I have found is a major push from President Obama and Secretary Salazar specifically on trying to find balance in our energy policy, a real effort to transition to clean energy from dirty energy, so move for renewables, looking at ways in which you can advance wind, solar, geothermal. The policy development is going, I think, quite well in that arena. The funding is changed significantly. There's a real balance. And I would say that as energy policy is being developed for renewables as well as for fossil fuels, there's a real sensitivity to the lands that have high conservation value and a desire to really protect those. With the Forest Service, I am finally seeing what I had dreamed of is a Forest Service that would move from being an agency that felt it had responsibility for cutting trees to one that felt it had a responsibility for restoring forest. And I see that movement in real terms, a real effort to change the culture and the management paradigm within the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm. Bill Meadows, what about nuclear power? I was not surprised. I was disappointed that Barack Obama was moving forward on nuclear power. I wasn't totally surprised because he had gotten a lot of funding from the nuclear power industry and actually during the campaign talked intermittently and favorably about nuclear power. What was your reaction to that?
I doubt that there is anyone, or very few at least, in the environmental community who favor the initiatives that have been undertaken in support of nuclear energy, guaranteeing loan payments, for example, is it props up an industry that economically is very suspect. I would say there's a policy a few weeks ago where new areas were open, or at least proposed to be open, for oil and gas development offshore.
Yeah, I wonder what your view of that was.
And these are. There's a balance here that's interesting. At the same time, there was an effort or there was a process begun to really look at the possibility of oil and gas development offshore the southern Atlantic from Delaware down and to do the same in the eastern Gulf off the state of Florida. There was a cancellation and actually a permanent withdrawal or what will, I think, become a permanent withdrawal of Bristol Bay from oil and gas development in Alaska, and a postponement of leases, cancellation of four leases, and a postponement of any new leasing in the Arctic Ocean. Now, critics of the president will say that all he has done is taken a timeout and put in place a process through which ultimately there will be oil and gas development offshore. Those of us who have watched this process over a long period of time know that there is at least now an effort to bring science into this decision. It's not totally biased on just on economic values. It's going to be colored, and I think decisions will be made based on ecological values as well.
The amazing thing, though, on the offshore drilling, excuse me for interrupting, Bill Meadows, but was just to go back and listen to what Obama said during the campaign when McCain flipped his own position on it. McCain was against offshore drilling, and then he was for it and was criticizing Obama not for being for it. Obama was really intelligent, I thought very courageous at the time, by saying, look, this isn't going to come on stream for 10 years. Even if it all came on stream, it wasn't going to affect ultimately how we could get to be energy self-sufficient. And yet here he is backtracking on that.
Well, looking back in the summer of 2008, there was a mantra in the country, drill, baby, drill, that caught, I think, many in the environmental community by surprise. Gas was selling at the pump at roughly coming up to about $4 a gallon, and people were vocal, and it became a political chant that colored, I think, the debate on energy policy in a pretty significant way. The Wilderness Society, along with a number of our colleagues, led the charge against that, and we really were pushing back hard. And ultimately, what happened is that the Congress, in its appropriation bill, failed to renew the moratorium on offshore. So what we had today going into this policy that he announced was no moratorium at all. And so what he did was essentially reinstate the moratorium offshore West Coast. So you don't have any drilling proposed or even being studied thought to be possible in the future from Washington through California or in the Northeast. So that, and that decision, I have to tell you, I think is very political. It's a decision that is colored by the current conversation that's going on with climate policy. There is a view that the only way we will pass climate legislation in this Congress is to have some support from Republican and moderate Democrats. And they're pushing for offshore development and as a trade-off in some ways to get votes for climate policy. There's a willingness to take steps, at least signal a willingness to put nuclear energy, offshore drilling on the table as part of the solution. The environmental community is, I think, in a very difficult position. There are few of us who support the legislation that's being discussed right now with whole heart. There is a balance, however, that I think we're all struggling with, is that we know that we're in transition from dirty fuel to clean fuel, clean energy. And we need to move that transition as fast as we can. And the faster we get a price on carbon, the faster that transition will occur. So there will be less development offshore. There will be less nuclear, we believe, if we move through that transition quickly and are able to encourage solar, wind, geothermal, conservation, real thoughtful, much more strategic clean energy choices.
Bill Meadows, how are we going to attach a price on carbon, though? This legislation, at least as I understand it, doesn't really attach a price on carbon, and there are a lot of bennies there for old fossil fuel companies.
You know, we're talking about this legislation before it's been introduced in the Senate, so all we know right now is what's rumored. House legislation did, in fact, have a lot of benefits for the traditional energy companies. In a sense, what was done was give people a transition time. And the bill is very powerful if you look at it. It's what would happen in 2016, but it's not terribly powerful in 2010. On the Senate side, we don't know exactly what will come. It is my belief that you will see a very strong target for meeting a renewable electricity standard. It would be a very strong target in reducing carbon by 17% by 2020. There will be but that will be placed on the utility industry. The transportation sector is going to be probably taxed at the refinery level, and those costs will be passed on to the consumer. The manufacturing interest will be similar to the utilities, but there'll be a pause. There'll be a 3, 4, or 5 year period which they can ramp up. Whether that is enough to capture 60 votes in this Senate is unknown. Right now, there's only one Republican, Lindsey Graham, who has committed to this legislation. I think that there's some good chance that Susan Collins from Maine ultimately will join in. But beyond that, there's no guarantee that any of these signals about offshore, nuclear, deferring implementation for manufacturing interest for a few years will pay off in getting votes. And that's troubling. We've got to find a way to, you know, push to success, but at the same time actually have success.
Right, because the more they dilute the bill to get people to vote for it, the less we're going to be able to save the planet.
That's true.
I mean, that's the real crisis of global warming that's just bearing down on us, is already borne down on us, according to Bill McKibben's latest.
The trade-off for most of us that are thinking about this in a political environment is that the next time we'll have a chance to even talk about this is 2013, so after the next presidential election. So the question, in so many of these issues that we deal with, do you let the perfect be the enemy of the good? The question here is whether this is the good. Is it good enough for us to really think that this is the high water mark for 2010? Could you get something better in 2013? Maybe, but the signals are not terribly strong, aren't encouraging that we would do better in 2013 than we're doing right now.
I'm speaking with Bill Meadows of the Wilderness Society. He's been head of that group for almost the last 14 years. I mean, you mentioned this drill, baby, drill slogan that came down the pike a year ago or 2 years ago with Sarah Palin. And I just wonder, you know, how that mentality strikes you, or how do you react when you see polls that say almost two-thirds of the American people don't think human beings or companies have anything to do with global warming?
Sarah Palin is a voice for the opposition, and, you know, she's a good voice, and I don't mind having her around. The rift in the right wing of the Republican, or really the conservative parties of our country, will accrue to the benefit of the Democrats. You know, I think that the efforts that you see many of the Republicans moving to the right on issues and trying to honor their relationship with the Tea Party or with Sarah Palin, aligned folk, will ultimately create a backlash. And it will be, you know, I see it already in the Wilderness Society works across the aisle, and we work frequently with moderate Republicans, and we have some of our strongest support from moderate Republican conservationist in, let's say, the Northeast. They abhor the way the party is being led today, and they're very much in opposition to the anti-conservation, anti-environmental policy message. I don't know where that's going to take the country, but I choose to believe that ultimately the Democratic Party, the more progressive interest, are going to benefit from having this split, this really highlight of the extreme on the right. There are going to be 25% of the population who will abide by that, but the other 25% or 30% who are more progressive, it's the middle that ends up making the choice, and they're beginning to be turned off by that that rhetoric, an extreme rhetoric on the right.
Bill Meadows, I hope you're right about that. I mean, I, in my bleaker moments, consider the possibility, if the economy is still bad, that, you know, Sarah Palin could win the nomination of the Republican Party just because the partisans come out and she's the person the partisans seem to like the most. And then who knows? That's the nightmare I have.
Well, even in the Tea Party movement, almost half do not believe that she has enough experience to be president.
Yeah, a lot of people thought that about Reagan too at the time. But so, listen, I wanted to throw a criticism at you that I hear from people like Jeffrey St. Clair and Alexander Coburn over at Counterpunch, that
sure,
the Wilderness Society, Sierra Club, and other Washington-based national big environmental groups are too mainstream or too closely tied to what's going on in Washington, or too bureaucratic and not activist enough.
You know, I think it's a fair criticism, and I think that it's – but it one needs to look a little more deeply. I will admit that, you know, I have spent a lifetime trying to find ways to reach solutions on problems. And in the position that I'm in now, I'm working on public land conservation. So I'm looking at ways in which we can get protection and get good management on our public lands in particular. And I found that it's generally better to try to work with the people in power than as best you can. You know, at the same time that I'm working with, even within the Bush administration, I tried to find ways to work with the Forest Service and the and the Department of Interior. And I was to say to some of my friends, really, and those in that administration, it was nice to be able to smile at the people you were going to sue. We have a very strong conservation ethic, and we're conscious of what we stand to gain and lose in any particular decision. The things that are happening are the public lands today cannot be delayed. The concerns that I have, for example, working on wilderness legislation in Idaho. In 1980, there were 700 registered ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, in the state of Idaho. In 2007, there were 175,000 ATVs registered in the state of Idaho. Those ATVs are going on public land. Every time they're out, they're damaging another place that needs to be protected. If we wait until next year to protect a place with wilderness, we are going to lose an enormous amount of acreage. Some places that are really special. So this is a constant evaluation for us. What is good enough? When do you need to act? If you have an opportunity for solutions, do you take it? It depends. Every decision is different. It's based on what's going to happen on the ground to the place that you're interested in. We will be criticized for settling for wilderness legislation that some think is too little. But the politics are not going to allow for more. Do you take it today, come back 5 years from now, begin again? We think so. And so there's always this consideration of what are we going to lose in the next 5 years or 8 years if we don't act today. And we get criticized for making that choice. And I think it's helpful, actually, to have those conversations, and it pushes the debate to a place where it gives, I think, those who are making the final negotiations and decisions greater power to settle for the most.
It's helpful to have that activist pressure.
Absolutely.
Now, this ATV thing, forgive my ignorance, is there a ban on ATVs on public lands, or
no.
Is there legislation to ban ATVs
no.
on public lands?
4 years ago, when we first began working seriously on the policy changes for ATV management. In the Forest Service, for example, there are 191 national forests. Excuse me, there are 191 million acres. I think there are 160 or so national forests. In half of the national forest, there was a policy that all land was open for ATV use except those that were closed. The other half, they were closed and left open. What we're trying to do is to get a coherent policy where off-road vehicles are limited to identified trails, and they're not going to go cross-country. Hmm. That's the biggest biggest problem is that there's not any control on ATVs right now. We need to get that policy straight.
I wish you luck on that one. That's an issue I didn't know anything about. Now I know something about it. Bill Meadows, head of the Wilderness Society, thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.